feel like this is the first day of school, and you know, it's September, and it is, and there you go. So everyone, everything's getting, you know. Thank you. Thank you, John. And we've got a real high-tech operation, so whenever I want to move the slide, I'm just going to point my hand at John, and it's going to automatically move. So that's... You know, but thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here. It's great to be on Michigan State's campus, and we got a little bit of a late start, so I'm going to skip a couple of things I usually do so we can get started, but I do want to introduce my wife, Terry Awal, in the back of the room, who has sat through more of these than she probably cares to, but she's an incredible supporter of mine, and I could not have gotten this project done without her, and that's the fact, Jack. My book, Built in Detroit, the story of the UAW, it's a story of a company. The company is the Briggs Manufacturing Company, located on the east side of Detroit. More about that in a few minutes. And a gangster. When I've been interviewed, people talk to me, they all want to know who the gangster is. Maybe I should wait till the end. No, I'll tell you now. The gangster is a man named Santo Peron, Sam Peron. Sam Peron was one of the most dangerous sons of bitches who ever walked the streets of Detroit. If you wanted someone killed, you can go see Santo Peron. You wanted to bust a union, you made contact with Sam Peron. You wanted illegal immigrants, illegal booze, Sam Peron was your man. He was an intimidator. He was a real piece of work. He was not a member of the mafia. He was a maverick. He was his own man, in some ways a character, but he was a very vicious person. Detroit. This book is about Detroit. And this is a picture taken in the early 1930s, and I love this photo. It's a photo that shows a city that in some ways hasn't changed too much in terms of its skyline, but in some ways is very, very different. And what, I'm a kind of transportation geek, so I look at those the passenger ships that were the preferred way to go up north if you had the money. because before the 30s especially, there were no decent roads to get up north. It took, you know, 6, 8, 10 hours just to get to the northern part of the state. So this is Detroit, and this is your author with his father, Ken Morris. The author is the guy eating the Cracker Jacks. My dad is the guy smoking the cigarette. And he would stop that within 10 years and live to be 92 years old. But I was Bobby, he was Ken, and what was so great about our lives together was, on one hand, he worked all the time. We didn't grow up like a lot of kids. But because he worked all the time, on weekends, my mom would say, "Ken, I want you to take the boys to meetings." And so my brother and I, the only responsibility we had that came from our mother, was don't fight, don't make a scene. Ken was elected to office. That was important to her. And we saw so much as kids growing up. We heard some of the best speakers and politicians and leaders of a generation, from obviously the Ruthers and other labor leaders, politicians from Jack Kennedy, Hubert Humphrey, Governor Williams, Martin Luther King, and so many others. It was a special opportunity growing up, one that I'm sure I did not appreciate at the time, but I certainly do now. But as John indicated, we're going to drill down a little bit in terms of the Briggs Manufacturing Company. And this is the first time I'm doing this, so I hope I don't ramble too much, but a lot of this story, you got to think of it as parallel time tracks. And so there'll be a couple of times where we move forward time-wise, but then we'll come back and catch up in another element of the story. But it's about the rebels, the people from Local 212. Local 212 was a very special local union, and I hope I can capture some of that uniqueness. Walter Briggs created an empire, the Briggs Manufacturing Company. This is Briggs sitting here in the dark hat on your right at his beloved Briggs Stadium. He owned the Detroit Tigers, built, the stadium was there, it was called Navin Stadium, but he turned it into a world-class ballpark. He loved the Tigers. We can get into how he managed the Tigers, that's a different discussion, but he loved the Tigers. But he couldn't come, this was just a byproduct. It was a byproduct of his company. The Briggs Manufacturing Company made auto bodies. Fisher Body made bodies for General Motors cars. Briggs essentially made auto bodies for all the other companies, Ford, Chrysler, Plymouth, Dodge, Hudson, Packard. They all came to Briggs. And I'm going to be very critical of Briggs, but it's very important. They actually were a very cutting-edge company. They came through with many creative ideas that allowed the upper part. Before Briggs, essentially, when you had a cab for a car, it was just dropped down, bolted on. Briggs figured out a way to make it streamlined and make it all one operation. It's very unique at the time. People said it couldn't be done, and he did it. They did also many other things. So they had a creative company, but ultimately, the way he treated employees, wages, Henry Ford, $5 a day guy, right? But for most of us who really understand this stuff, Henry Ford didn't do $5 a day because he was a great guy. He did it because he was concerned about being organized by the Wobblies in 1913 and 14. So 15, he comes up with the $5 a day program. Now he had to figure out a way to reduce wages. One of the ways he did it is he outsourced. He outsourced to Briggs. Briggs's biggest failure was with his employees. He essentially treated them like dirt, and it would come back to haunt his company. That, in terms of Detroit and his reputation in Detroit, really sullied him. This is the epicenter of the Briggs Manufacturing Company. It's the Mack Avenue Stamping Plant. How many people are familiar with the east side of Detroit? A couple. A couple. Out here would be Mack Avenue. The plant stretched a half mile long to Warren Avenue. To the east would be St. Jean Street. A little bit further down would be Connor Avenue. Our friends from Local 7 were on Connor. And it was a huge place. They employed anywhere between 15 to 30,000 people in that plant, just in that plant. He would have other plants in the Detroit area as well, but this was the big baby. But it was very tough to manage. There were little pockets of departments all over the place. When my dad worked there, there were people he never knew. And it's just the way it was. It was just a big, big place. And so that was one plant. Then, like I said, he had other plants throughout the Detroit area. This one started out as the Ford manufacturing plant in Highland Park. Plant is still there. And when Ford moved to the Rouge plant in the early 1920s, this plant was still there, and it was empty. Well, Briggs took over part of it and made his bodies for the Ford Motor Company. So this was one big, very important plant through the 20s and the 30s in the Briggs Empire. 1927, Briggs, a fire started. 21 auto workers were killed. Now, the interesting thing is, even in the newspapers, who were definitely not pro-worker, very pro-employer, they ripped Briggs on his safety standards. They said it was a very, very dangerous place to work. And of course, if you were African-American, you worked in some of the most dangerous parts of the plant health-wise, and in fact, the majority of the people who died were African-Americans in this plant, some of whom were players on the Detroit Stars Negro Baseball League. So Briggs has a reputation as a tough place to work. But when the Depression came, as this gentleman said, all you want is a job. Don't want charity, you want a job. And that is why many, many people worked at Briggs. 1933, there's going to be a strike at Briggs. It was one of the very early semi-successful strikes that took place. The Auto Workers Union, it was an independent union, took Briggs on. They would be perceived, and in fact were, a communist union, but they got the support of the Briggs workers. My belief is no union can survive without the support of its workers. I don't care whether communist, socialist, Republican, Democratic, left or right-leaning. You got to have the workers who are supporting what your actions. And they got the support. The strike lasted nearly 3 weeks. Very few photos, because the newspapers didn't cover the strike. And most people in Detroit weren't even aware that there was a strike. The union, AWU, had no institutional support. And this is going to be huge when the UAW starts to develop first as an AFL affiliate, then as a CIO affiliate. There was support, whether it was a public relations machine, a research department, an organizing department. Those were tools that made unions successful, especially in the 30s. Frank Murphy. I'm going to talk about Frank Murphy. Most people know Frank Murphy as being governor of Michigan and the guy who made sure that when the National Guard was sent to Flint, that the guard didn't open fire on workers. Frank Murphy's an incredible human being, and more needs to be told about Frank Murphy. He became mayor. He was, a judge in Detroit, became mayor, then became governor, then ambassador to the Philippines under Franklin Roosevelt, attorney general, and then on the U.S. Supreme Court. And he died really as a young man, I think around 44, 45. So a very special guy. Governor, or that's fine. That's fine. Murphy told Briggs, basically, you got to end this strike. It's non-productive. You're causing trouble. Stop it. As did the Ford Motor Company. They wanted their bodies. They wanted to keep production going, which would be a theme with the Ford Motor Company. They didn't want unions, but they don't want anything to slow down production. The Murphy Report, the commission that Murphy developed after the strike, they found out that in many cases, not in some cases, wages could be as low as $2.94 for a two-week work period. They found that people would report to work, and they were kind of told, well, we don't have a specific assignment for you. You guys stay over here for a while. And after 4 or 5 hours, they said, well, we don't have anything for you. Go home. No wages, no support, nothing. Dust and particles of metal particles were in the air in certain departments so that after a few weeks, somebody could work in these departments and they could be spitting up blood. And then after a while, they'd simply disappear. It was tough. One guy said in the report, why the hell would I strike during the worst depression in history unless I was desperate? And desperate these people were. And that's how they perceived things. Briggs would address the problems. They'd made some changes. But they hired a former Pinkerton, Faye Taylor, to head up their employee relations. He was an anti-union man. That's what Pinkertons were known for, busting unions. And that's who Briggs hired to deal with their labor. Now, that's 33. The years are going to roll by. Franklin Roosevelt was president. He and his other capitalists, they weren't fans of the unions, but they were really afraid that the workers of America were going to move way to the left, that they'd be enticed by communism, socialism, or any other kind of ism. So as his 100 days developed, they actually decided that, yeah, we're going to help companies any way we can, but we're going to allow unions to exist. And that could be a way to modify the workers in America. In 1935, after a false start, the National Labor Relations Act is going to get passed, the Wagner Act. That's going to allow private sector unions to exist. Strikes could be legal. But most importantly, the National Labor Relations Board was created, and this was an enforcement tool that had tremendous influence in terms of the growth of the labor movement. But back at Briggs, by 1936, life on the line's continuing. Safety standards were somewhat improved. By this time, my dad's working in the plant, but he still found a glove that had fingers in it, you know, and guy at the tool crib shakes the glove out, finger pops out, looks at it, throws it in the trash. That's the way things were at Briggs. In the summer, plant could get, this is a good day for this, the plant could become 115 degrees in the inside, so hot that men might wear gloves to deal with the metal as they were building and moving and on the assembly line, stamping press would come down, grab the metal, move it. But if that metal hit your arm, your skin would just peel off. Or you could be working and there could be a water fountain literally 10 feet away from you, but you couldn't get any water because the line was moving. Couldn't stop the line. You couldn't leave your spot until you had a lunch break. That was it. That's the way it was. Wages, 43 cents an hour if you made production. And it was designed so you couldn't make production. Very difficult to make production. So you didn't make those 43 cents an hour. There's no health care, no job security. Foreman didn't like something you said, maybe just didn't like you. You could be gone like that. And that's the way it was. There's essentially no dignity for the worker at Briggs. Now, a couple of things are going to change in 1936. Amo Mazie, someone who is like an uncle to me, and I say is because even though he's been gone a long time, he's still a force in my life. Amo Mazie was a very unique guy. And he was a socialist. He started out, graduated from Cass Tech High. He wanted to be a violinist. Played the violin, had his own band that he played events at in Detroit, he and some other guys. And Emil, but you know, the Depression came, the idea of being a concert violinist dissipated, and he decided he was going to dedicate his life to help working people. And that's what he did. Dick Frankenstein, somebody we don't talk too much about anymore, sitting here with Walter Reuther. Dick Frankenstein was a football player, an all-Detroit football player. Went to Dayton University, became a school teacher. The Depression hit. He lost his job as a teacher, came back to Detroit, worked at Dodge, Maine. He was the president of Local 3. And a very interesting guy. He and Walter Reuther, in the early years of the UAW, their careers paralleled. They were competitors. UAW is full of ambitious people. That was the nature of the beast. And Dick Frankenstein and Reuther would compete. But in the case of Local 212 and the Briggs Company, it was Dick Frankenstein and Emil Mazie who got things started in terms of union organization. UAW, as I indicated, started out in 1935, and they were organized under the AFL group of people. There were some dissident unions inside the AFL who thought the AFL was ignoring manufacturing companies, unskilled workers. These were people who could really be organized. John L. Lewis led that group that ultimately in 1936 became the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO. In 1936, the UAW is going to become part of the UAW-CIO. Homer Martin will be its first president. In December of 36, there's kind of an explosion of strikes that take place. 1936, the GM sit-down strike begins, and late in the year. A little earlier in December, Kelsey Hayes, a company that made brakes on the west side of Detroit, gets organized by Walter Reuther, Victor Reuther, and a man named George Edwards, who's a very unique, special person in Michigan history. Emil Mazie, meanwhile, Emil's at Briggs, and he's instigating all kinds of strikes, little wildcat strikes, sit-down strikes in the plant. And finally, in December, Briggs fingers him, and they fire him. And they walk him down to the Mack Avenue entrance, and they throw him out on the street. And Emil gets up, and he had a stutter in those days. But he gets up, and he says, "I'll be back, you sons of bitches. I'll be back, and I'm going to organize this plant." Well, the International UAW will hire Emil as an organizer and the guy dedicated to organizing Briggs a couple of weeks later. In January, as these things often happen, Emil's going around talking to potential labor leaders. Frankenstein's doing his thing with the people he knew at Briggs. But the unexpected happened. Somebody got fired at one of the Briggs plants. And when he got fired, the plant just said, "Baloney, I'll be polite, baloney. We're not going to put up with this." And they went out, they did a sit-down strike. And all of a sudden, things came together. And in 37, the company would fire tear gas at the workers to try to get them out of the plant. It didn't work. What did eventually happen, though, is the company was very good at scaring the workers who were in the plant. And after about 10 days, what started as 300 guys in the Meldrum plant turned into about 6 people. So they thought, well, gee, the sit-down strike's not working as well as we wanted. And so they left the plant, but they did mass picketing around the plant and shut it down. It was Emil Mazie who organized those pickets. And it was one of the best picket lines ever held. There were battles with the police. At one point, the mounted police came in, and the workers had, being prepared for this eventuality, had marbles in their in their pockets or bags, and they threw the marbles down while the horses would panic And it was, it was a great deal. In fact, a friend of mine came up with that idea, a guy named Paul Silver, but a friend of mine, friend of our family. But an interesting time. And eventually, after this two-week period, Ford tells Briggs, we want you to stop this strike. We're not saying we want you to recognize a union, but damn it, we want our bodies. We want to keep production going. Harry Bennett was instrumental in that. And so the company sat down and started negotiating with the workers. And that was a special time. The UAW was going to charter Local 212, the Briggs local. And that was very good. The 212 people, primarily led by Mazie and Frankenstein, negotiate with Faye Taylor. What should have been a week's worth of negotiations turned into 2 months' worth of negotiations. But negotiate they did. Emil Mazie becomes, there's a false start. A guy got elected president of Local 212. It turns out he was a total disaster and was removed. Emil Mazie became the president. He was just 25 years old, the thing I'm going to come back to. 25 years old, he's running a local union that has at first 5,000, then 10,000, 20,000 members, became the largest local union in the UAW before Local 600. Local 212 is going to be known for its cutting-edge contracts. They're going to be known for diversity in the workplace and their flying squadron. The flying squadron is a special group of people. They were volunteers who said, we will help any local union anywhere in the city. We'll support them on their picket lines. We'll support workers wherever they are. And we will stand up to the police. It was a special time. These were all incredibly young. Some of these people might have been socialists, some communists, some Catholics, were just basically rank and file members. And this is who my dad was. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. They were tough, headstrong, militant UAW members. Members at times where the International Union wasn't going to be happy with what these dead-end kids did. In fact, sometimes, more often than not, the dead-end kids were a total pain in the ass to the International Union. But that's who they were, and they didn't hide it. Some of the dead-end kids. This is a 1941 convention picture. That's my dad, Ken, standing. Over here, standing up in the second row, is Emil Mazie. His brother, Bill Mazie, a fine, fine labor attorney and a good, good friend. Is there. But if you look at these people, you see a couple of things. One, these are basically pretty young people. Two, it is a diverse crowd, not as diverse as perhaps we would want to see, but for the times, very diverse in terms of African Americans. There's some women. It was moving forward where other locals weren't. Emil Mazie, five-time president of Local 212. He would have a stormy career. He was he attracted controversy. He was that kind of guy. He could make a statement and a quote. Faye Taylor would say in the press, well, we need to do some horse trading in terms of working out a contract. And Emil would say, my people aren't horses, they're human beings. Or, there's just time and time again where he'd make these statements. Emil, again, very young. He was elected five times UAW president, but not all consecutively. He lost some elections. And one election he loses in 1940, he ends up organizing, being put to work organizing for the International UAW at Ford. And he helps, and in fact, they put him in the area that was organizing the minority workers at Ford. And there are some rubs about that. But in fact, Emil's record in terms of dealing with diversity and human rights was unparalleled. And that's why he was so special. This is my dad, Ken Morris. This is his high school graduation picture. Ken graduated from high school at Oliver High School in Pittsburgh, graduated with honors. In our world today, there's no question he'd go to college. No question. Well, that wasn't the case in 1933. And Ken basically becomes finds work as a traveling salesman in and around Pittsburgh, doing the mining. The company store was very real in the mining towns and steel towns of Pittsburgh. His kind of Fuller Brush team were the provided some competition. They did very well. They said, well, you know what? We can go see the rest of the country. We can do this gig anywhere. So he and four of his buddies come to Detroit, then they're gonna go to Chicago, St. Louis, California. They're gonna be gone at least a year, they tell everybody. So these guys all come to Detroit. Ken's there on the second to the left. They all get to Detroit, and within a month, every one of them goes back home. Ken was so stubborn that he stayed, but he couldn't find work. He couldn't find work, and he spent 6 months looking. He was staying at the Mariners' rescue mission on Jefferson or near Jefferson, and finally he heard about work at Briggs, and he got hired. That's a story in and of itself. There's going to be some shameless plugs about my book, and if you want to know more about that, you read the book. There's an important mission here, and it's true with so much. Even though there's fighting, a lot of infighting inside the UAW, with this group of people, the leader of Local 212 was Emil Macy. Ken's a great friend of Emil. Emil's a little bit of a mentor initially for Ken, and then Ken becomes his own man. But even when my dad's mind was laced with dementia, I could say to him, Dad, were you a Macy man? Or no, are you a Macy man? He'd say, you're damn right I'm a Macy man. He was a Macy man, and that was important. And it's also important to know that Ken and Emil were Ruther men. We're going to talk about Walter in a little bit. But there was an understanding. These guys might fight like cats and dogs. I've got some letters that are in the book that Emil says some things about Walter that are just amazing. But they always supported each other. So that's the way it was. Jess Ferrazza, another one of the dead-end kids. This is Jess delivering a drop kick to this guy in 1940 at the Ford Rouge plant, a demonstration that gets out of hand. I saw this photo in 1974 at the Light Guard Armory, and I was stunned because I looked at it, and I could see on the jackets, Local 212 Flying Squadron. And then I looked and said, that's Jess. Jess is another one of these guys who's like an uncle to me. One of the quietest, most soft-spoken guys I ever saw. And I said to Jess, when I saw him a few weeks later, I said, Jess, I can't believe you guys from Local 212 ganged up on this fella. Local 212, UAW, truth, justice, and the American way. That's not what you do. Jess goes, well, you know what? I'm somebody who spent 30 years dealing with this photo. And what people don't know is they see that image, but they don't see what was happening 2 minutes before. And this picture won the first Pulitzer Prize photo in the country. It's in the Washington, D.C. Museum. And there's a little commentary by the photographer who says essentially the same thing. He says, you know, I could see what those Ford Motor Company guys, thugs, were doing. And I knew there'd be a pushback, and I was going to be there to take that shot when the pushback came. And that's how this photo got taken. Flying Squadron. Jess, Ken, Emil, all of these guys were part of the Flying Squadron. This is a federal screw strike. Walter Ruther needed help. He called on the Flying Squadrons of all local unions to help out. And here you see the Detroit police going after the picketers, most on mounted, some on their feet, all with the batons. These people are putting their lives on their line for their union. They get whacked by a baton, they might not go to work the next day. they get ID'd on one of these lines, they might be blacklisted. They're putting their lives on the line. I've never done that, ever. Well, and then these guys are the flying squadrons and the picketers who are fighting back. This is a rough and tough time inside the city of Detroit. Another strike's 1939, Briggs, there's a Briggs strike between Local 212 and Briggs. Joe Ferris, another president of Local 212, he's being arrested here. 2 days later, he's gonna get shot in the leg, not by the company, not by the police, but by the supporters of the UAW-AFL, who are in conflict with the UAW-CIO. This strike is gonna demonstrate the first effort inside the UAW to demonstrate that the UAW-CIO had the vast, vast majority of support versus the UAW-AFL and Homer Martin. World War II is gonna come, UAW is here to stay, but there's gonna be some people at Briggs, at Ford, who say, after the war, we're gonna have to deal with this. But that's down the road. Meanwhile, people like my dad join the Army, in this case, the Army Air Corps. He's gonna go and serve for four and a half years. He is in Texas building air bases. He becomes kind of the Burt Lancaster of his base, running everything, at least in my mind, but without the sex part, or so I thought, because that's where he meets my mom, and they get married, and my brother and I are, of course, very happy they did. But Ken makes clear to Doris that, you know what, after the war, we're going back to Detroit. I'm gonna continue my career at Local 212 and the UAW. That was understood. In fact, my mom would say to her sons, you know, your dad married someone before me. And he loves that someone, the UAW, far more than he loves me. I don't know if that's accurate, but that's how she viewed the world. 1946, Ken comes back. He's elected by acclamation as recording secretary of his union. He was in charge of the newspaper. He wrote an editorial criticizing the Briggs Company. And he ends up being being beaten to within an inch of his life. He was one of several people, colleagues, who were beaten. In this case, he had two fractures of his skull, broken arm, broken leg. He was a mess. It took months for him to recover, but he did recover. He would go on to be a strong union leader. And while he's moving on, Briggs, with its hatred of unions, loses their way. They cease to become the innovating company because they're so obsessed with weakening and getting rid of the UAW. As the leaders move on, Emil Mazie's gonna come back from the war. Emil actually led protests in the Philippines to demobilize the military. Amazing guy. He comes back, he's gonna be elected to the International Executive Board, become the number two guy to Walter Reuther. Ken's gonna be president of Local 212 from 1948 to 55. Then he will go on the executive board. And these two guys will serve together and are very proud of the years they spent there. There's gonna be more investigations at Briggs. There's gonna be a one-man grand jury. Santo Perone places a crooked cop as the top lead police officer as that one-man grand jury. So needless to say, not much happened. Then Santo Perone's gonna threaten the judge. He's gonna say, you indict anybody and someone's gonna die in your family. It's that simple. Then in 1951, the Kefauver Committee comes to Detroit. Kefauver Committee, for you Godfather geeks out there and Godfather II, that's the Kefauver Committee. If you've seen On the Waterfront, the committee that's involved, that's the Kefauver Committee. And the Kefauver Committee is gonna do 2 days of hearings, and they ultimately will destroy Briggs's reputation, because this is the president of the company, Dean Robinson, saying, we've never worked with gangsters. We've never been involved with gangsters. The senators didn't believe them. Emil's going to testify. These were televised live on grainy black and white TVs in Detroit. Then Santo Perone's going to testify. He goes, I don't know nothing about Briggs. I don't know nothing about strikes. I don't know nothing about any labor violence. I don't know nothing. Well, the committee didn't believe him, and the report was that came out a few months later just ripped the company. Meanwhile, Briggs, because of all of this, their name fades. They ultimately sell out to the Briggs to Chrysler in 1954. And now I'm going to come to a little fork in the road. So bear with me because we're going to go back in time a little bit. I want to talk about the Ruther brothers. We have, from your left to right, Roy Ruther, Victor Ruther, Walter Ruther. All great labor leaders. Roy was, people don't know Roy like they should. This guy was a great, great organizer. He and a guy named Bob Travers were the two people most responsible for the success of the sit-down strike in 19 at General Motors in Flint. A very special guy. In 1964, Walter Ruther is going to get a call from Lyndon Johnson. He's going to say, Walter, we need to organize Negroes in the South to vote. And I want your brother Roy to go down there and do it. That was the reputation Roy had. Victor Ruther, that's all right. I should do that with my left hand. Victor Ruther, an orator, a true believer in labor's cause. In many ways, the conscience of both Roy and Walter. Very special guy. And then Walter. Walter Ruther was the leader. I mean, and there are people who would have issues with Walter, and there are issues that were certainly legitimate issues to have. But Walter, whether it's at the Battle of the Overpass and the beating he and Dick Frankenstein took by Harry Bennett's thugs, he is going to play an important role. It's going to take him 11 years to become president of the UAW. But when he does, he tries to take the union more from more than a union and a bread and butter union, but to do more things. Walter Ruther. Time magazine in 1999 said Walter Ruther is one of the 100 most influential Americans ever. One of the 100 most influential Americans. I mean, I don't know any. He's the only influential American who is on the top 100 list that I know. A very special guy. Creator of the 500 planes a day concept in 1940. He's worked on this. He gives a national speech on the radio. Talks about how we've got a war coming. We need to get prepared for it. We can turn our auto factories into factories that can produce what we will need to be in that war effort. We can make 500 planes a day. He, more than anyone else, came up with the idea of the turning Detroit into the arsenal of democracy. The big three leaders said, my God, this guy's a union guy. He's a socialist. He's a communist. He's this, he's that. He doesn't know anything about manufacturing things. Well, in fact, of course, we know exactly what happened, and we did become the arsenal for democracy. Creative negotiator, developed health care, pensions. Many believe, and I certainly do, that he helped create the middle class as we know it. First creator of an HMO in the United States. It's now HAP, the Health Alliance Plan. Civil rights leader, longtime supporter of Martin Luther King, Cesar Chavez, and other very important people. He helped organize the March on Washington. There are five people who spoke that day. I was there, but I didn't speak. Five people spoke. One of them was Walter Ruther. Supported the first environmental speech I ever heard. Was 1966, Cobo Hall, delivered by Walter Ruther. I remember it like it were yesterday. 1948, Ruther's standing in his kitchen on his house on Appaline Street in West Detroit, and he moves to hear something his wife is saying. Just as he moves, a shotgun blast blows through the window of his kitchen and nearly takes off his arm. Doctors wanted to amputate it. He says, no, can't do that. I'm not going to live that way. He ends up developing his own rehab program. He has a sponge ball, carries with him all the time, working at night. He'd get home. 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night. He'd always go down and spend at least 2 hours in his basement doing carpentry. He became a master carpenter. He recovered much use of his arm. It's a special story. But that story is going to be blackened when Victor Reuther is sitting in his living room, and he is reading. He's reading, and a shotgun blast goes off, nearly rips his face off. He loses an eye. His face is scarred for life. So who's doing this? We don't know. Walter's recovering here about a year later with Governor Williams, Emil Mazie, and his young daughter, Linda. Soapy Williams, he wants J. Edgar Hoover to come in and figure out who's responsible for this. Hoover says, it's not my jurisdiction. I'm not going to do it. And so nothing really happens. This is, as time goes on, there's the UIW executive board. Here's Reuther, Emil Mazie, my dad, walking into the executive board. Local 212 achievements. They were a lead union in negotiating all kinds of benefits. They were ahead of the curve. They stopped, they made Briggs stop sending workers home without pay. They were one of the first to negotiate a form of health care benefits. They fought for equal pay for equal work for men, women, and minorities, well ahead of their time. As I indicated, they were lead in the fight against the UAW-CIO versus the AFL. They fought for and got paid vacation. They broke racial barriers at their administration office, basically the secretaries. Emil said, we're going to have a diverse workplace. And some of the people didn't like that, but that's the way it was. The flying squadron was unequaled. They were a leader in the fight against, and there was a true battle in the 40s between communist elements and other elements of the UAW. They were a leader in what was called the Reuther right-wing caucus. And eventually, the communist efforts would decline. Local 212 and UAW members are going to thrive. No one's ever going to be convicted of the Briggs beatings or the Reuther shootings. No one. Detroit police said, that's intra-union stuff. But you have to read my book to get more details there. Walter Briggs is going to die in 1952. The Briggs name fades away, kind of with when Tiger Stadiums went down. In my mind, that was kind of the end of Briggs. Santo Perón's going to get blown up in 1964. Mafia members decide, we've got to get rid of this guy. He's going to lose a leg, a testicle. He's a mess. He still manages to kill people. Local 212 leaders and UAW members and leadership tend to thrive. They become part of their community. They get active in all kinds of things, and especially local politics. My dad, in a shameless plug, is a really good example of that. This is a picture of Ken introducing Jack Kennedy in Labor Day 1960 in Pontiac, Michigan, a rally he organized. Ken believed in political action. He wasn't one of these guys that liked people under his thumb, though there are some people who liked that. That wasn't his approach. His approach was to find young people who had the same values that he felt were important for leaders. He helped people, obviously JFK, Governor Jim Blanchard, Sandy Levin, Congressman Levin. Those people are still around. If you see them, you can ask. Ask them about Ken Morris. I think they'll say good things. Phil Hart, G. Menon Williams, all special people. Now, one final slide here. People will say, well, all right, you wrote the book. What's it got to do with today? Well, I believe that, you know, everyone talks about, oh, there's a decline in the middle class. Well, I find it amazing that more people don't say, yeah, there's a decline in the middle class, but it parallels the decline in union membership. That's a big, big issue. It doesn't happen in Europe. Strong middle class, strong union membership. I believe there is an issue of the 99 versus 1% economic problem in our country. You know, is it a good thing? Wall Street's doing better than ever, but Main Street isn't? I mean, frankly, let's come to Detroit. You know, I don't begrudge Bill Ford making $15, $20 million a year. I don't begrudge the mayor or the CEO of GM making $15 million a year. What I What upsets me is that the middle class wages are at what they were in 1973, and they're not getting any of that wealth. That's my problem. Unions, love them or hate them, they fought for benefits. They fought for decency. They fought for safety. They fought for working people. Who else has? I can't think of anyone. And with that, I'm all through. That's my story. I'm sticking to it. Thank you. If there's time for any questions or comments, I'm open. And we will be selling some books if anybody's interested afterwards. Yeah, Jim.
Let's jump right in.
Okay. Yep.
Did I get it right?
You got it right.
Okay. Where are the dead end kids now? For the UAW? For the union?
Oh, for the. No. Well.
Are they there?
There are people.
My impression, and I'm a strong union supporter, is that the international desperately needs some dead end kids.
I'm not going to disagree with that. I think the UAW needs to be, it is, even though people might think it's not, it is a democratic organization. It has to be. The challenge of anyone is to form a group of people and caucuses that can promote discussion, debate, argument, and policy. The administrative caucus, which was the old Reuther caucus, is very much in control. But people inside that caucus can still argue, debate, and fight. I don't know to what degree that goes on today. And I think that's unfortunate. And people should be part of the debate. When you go through the minutes of the conventions from the 30s and the 40s, you see the fight that's going on. And you know, then you look at the convention minutes of the 60s and 70s, there's not that much, you know, there's some people who get up and kind of raise hell, but they don't have the support of the union members. Now, I once gave my dad pretty close to a heart attack when I was reading a book about organized labor written in the 70s. I can't remember the name of it, but it talked about the Teamsters. And it talked about how the Teamsters, they have elections that are direct elections. And workers from plants all over the country, they vote for the president's office. And I said, Dad, that's a much more democratic approach. Why wouldn't you want to do that? And my dad was driving, and I think he damn near drove off the road. But he said, no, that's absolutely, you're so wrong. Because if you're Jimmy Hoffa or Frank Fitzsimmons or James R. Hoffa, you have, by being president, you can go anywhere in the country. You can campaign, develop support, and so forth. When you have a representative democracy, which is what the UAW is, where elected people, delegates, come to a convention, anything can happen at that convention. It may not happen as we see it now, but it certainly did. That's how Walter Reuther got elected, was the delegates at the Cleveland Convention in 1946 came and they said, we're not gonna go with R.J. Thomas, the president. We're going with this redheaded kid, you know? So. You can debate that in a lot of different ways. I don't have the pure answer. All I know is I know the structure is there. It can, there's UAW regional directors who don't get reelected. I've seen that happen any number of times. You know, there are UAW presidents in local unions who, that is changing on a semi-regular basis. So the democracy does work. I think the higher up you go, the harder it is. The incumbency is strong, but that's up to workers and the members, the active members of the union, to address. Yes. Yep. Bill.
Bill Parker. I'm a member of Local 1700 of EKW and past president of my local for 6 terms. First of all, I just want to thank you for your presentation and this book. I'm very anxious to read it. I knew Ken over a period of 30 years or so.
Can everybody hear Bill?
Yes.
Good.
Yep.
Turn around.
Thanks you, if that's better.
Go ahead. Oh, you were that guy. I remember now.
Eventually, as later in life, ended up quite close. I remember the last time that I spoke with him was Labor Day parade some time ago, where he did a very good talk about the past and our history and the city of Union and so on. And I can give you a lot of answers to your question about why. Focus really on the transition of the Union from a crusade against the conditions that Bob presented so eloquently into an institution. And as an institution, UAW is a different organization than it was as a crusade fighting injustices that Bob described. But I just want to say something about Ken, if I may, and that is that I've worked with work at Chrysler, work with many African American workers who either worked with Ken or came up just shortly after that and certainly knew of him. And the loyalty that existed towards Ken for the kind of positions that he took in the 40s was tremendous. That in a period of time in which there were racially motivated strikes taking place in the plants, white workers walking out because black workers for the first time were being allowed to work in areas that were not the worst areas of plants. And white workers seeing that as an attack on them, on their privilege of a little bit of privilege that they had, walked out. And Ken, as a leader, took the position that that's not going to happen. And told them to go back to work. Them that this union supported all of the members of the union, black and white. And the position that he took, as I say, was developed tremendous loyalty that existed 30 to 40 years later. Not to say that Ken was perfect. And, you know, one of my questions with Ken was then why, as a strong supporter of equality and civil rights, 40s, 25 years later, as there was rebellions in the plants, protesting the discrimination in the plants, in my opinion, things on the wrong side in those efforts, as black workers tried to organize to challenge the discrimination, both within the company and unfortunately within the union. But I think Ken was a great leader, a great man. I'm proud to have known him. Perhaps wish our paths had been more together earlier on, but you know, sometimes it takes a while to see what's positive in each one. Each of us a while to see.
I think so, just
so,
yeah.
Put that in the form of a question, Bob, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So,
I think that's a very legitimate issue. And I'm not sure I've got the perfect answer. I don't know that there is. I think where Ken came from was, you know, we mentioned the UAW became an institution. Well, it was governed. You know, from the time that a contract got signed, even in 1937, and Briggs was famous for wildcat strikes, Emil Mazy and Dick Frankenstein put out a letter to all of the UAW members and said, we have a contract now. We've got a grievance procedure. We've got a process. We need to follow that process. The company has agreed to follow that process. and they believed it. And when they had trouble with wildcat strikes, it was usually because people didn't want to, they just wanted to go on a small wildcat strike in a department and move forward. I think that Ken believed in the, not in a closed institution, but he believed in the process. And I think with Drum and some of the things that went on, I think on an individual basis, he would have a discussion. But when he felt meetings were being taken over and the democratic process wasn't being respected is where he had issues. And you know, this is something that could get debated in a lot of different ways. But I don't think the UAW was a company union. I think it was a union that believed in using the process. And I think that might be, and you probably saw it, Bill, a little more certainly than I did, but that might be where how he would come down. But he also wanted to listen, and he loved talking to people. Other questions or comments? Yes, sir.
Just looking in the newspaper this morning, the judge in Michigan ruled that the NEA, the right to work law, can lose members at any time, not only during the one-year period. So, you know, the pressure of the union and stuff.
They're fighting for their lives.
You can look at the paper day to day, you can read and see it in Michigan.
And one thing that drives me nuts about the right to work issue and the way I may be a little partisan here, and if I am, excuse me, but the way the right wing shapes the argument is that right to work, but of course people should have the right to work. Well, all right, fine. People don't want to join a union? They don't have to join a union. Oh, but wait a second. Under federal law, if a union negotiates benefits for people in the plant or in a jurisdiction, everybody gets those benefits. I don't think the general public understands that. I think they'd say, well, you can't force someone to join a union. Hey, you don't want to join the union? Fine. Then you negotiate on your own. You see how you're going to get benefits. But that's not the way it works. And I think that's, and I was, while I had was up here for other business, I was here when the right to work stuff went through. I saw the mounted police outside. I saw outside the Capitol. I saw a lot of stuff. And I'm proud to say that the organization I work for actually sent a letter saying it's not right, it's not the time for right to work. It's not the time for this discussion. We have to come together. And you know, I was proud to be able to deliver that letter to the governor's office. But the right to work, and I mean, I think to some degree, labor today is so paranoid about internal battles because they want to be as strong as they can externally. Whether that's a right model or not, I don't know.
Well, yeah.
Late 30s, yes.
Right.
No, I think that's a very, very good analysis. And in fact, I knew there were going to be people in this room who knew a hell of a lot more about these things than I do. I just see it from a certain level. And many of you have been involved with studies and, you know, direct involvement. But I do want to say one thing, and you triggered a thought, and we didn't get into this. Local 212 was absolutely opposed to the no-strike pledge of World War II. And they demonstrated on the floor at the Grand Rapids UAW convention in 1944 on this issue. But when I was doing my research down at the Reuther Archives, I ran across this very cool piece of paper, White House stationery. And I mean, there's something about the way the letters were etched that, you know, were very special. And Walter's writing is on this, and he's kind of doodling, you know. But he writes, no strike pledge. Underlines it, kind of boxes it in, underlines it. And I found this piece of paper. I don't know what the hell it all meant. But in my own mind, I could see Reuther maybe with the other UAW leaders in a room, maybe with a Harry Hopkins, maybe the president, maybe somebody else, and they're having this discussion. And I could hear the leadership being told that if we don't fight labor organization of the munitions factories, we've got to have a no-strike pledge. Now, I don't know if that happened, but I could see it happening. And so the leadership has to make these judgment calls, right or wrong. And I think, and UAW membership shot over 1 million during World War II. It dropped down and then picked back up. So it was a great growth period for the UAW without fighting, without going through all of the fights around the country. So, you know, I think, yeah, you got to put all of these things into perspective. But the UAW is like any political organization, is tough. And my mom used to say, UAW politics are the worst politics ever, far tougher than running for office. And I don't know if that's true or not, but we got some interesting calls from time to time in our household.